Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Techromancy Scrolls, New Cali, by Eric Schubach. Narrated by Holly Jackson. Prologue. I closed my eyes as I sat in the Garden of the Great Mother, listening, my ears straining, catching murmuring voices on the breeze that teased like ethereal promises that were just out of grasp. They were ever present there in the Whispering Walls Mountains which bisected the lower 10 realms of Sparrow. Many have gone mad trying to make sense of the whispers, thinking to have caught the voices of loved ones long since past, or learning of a prophetic future which then comes to pass. But more seek the solace and peace the whispers instill inside them, like the ghosts of voices welcoming them home with a warm embrace. All the times I had traveled through the range, catching those phantom voices on the wind, I never would have imagined that all of these tales could be true. Once becoming the co-ruler of all of the realms and having the mantle of Great Mother of Sparrow thrust upon me by trickery and happenstance, I learned the truth of it all. My predecessor and architect of my current fate, the former Great Mother Rennell, has been instructing me on all the secrets of the Great Mothers that are passed down from one generation to the next. Now the burden of these secrets and their unbelievable truths are my responsibility now. Rain had shared with me that those voices that echoed around the peaks, centered here around Father Stone, the most imposing peak in the range, are those of all the people in Alti of the Touched. Those who hold or will hold a spark of magic within them. Past, present, or future, it makes no matter to the mountains who stand witness to the world around them like sentinels of history. It is something in the magic which connects us all, and only if you listen long enough, letting the world fall away and only exist for the whispers to tease and play with your senses, can you catch the words of those you left behind in the steady march of life, and sometimes voices of the future echo back through the breeze to entice or torment you with the possibilities of that which is still to come. I smiled at the echoing memory of something that was both my past and present, as well as my future. Of my love, my life, of the night of my heart. My Celeste's playful whisper, "Lainey," drifted through my awareness. I held on to this moment, for it was not to last. I have barely had a moment of respite in which to rest in the past 3 years since fate played the awful trick on me of making me, Lainey Herder, Chicken Herder of Wexbury Keep, a ruler. Because with that title, my life is no longer my own. And I long for moments like this, where I can catch my breath between performing my duties for the people, the mountain gypsies of Sparrow, and for the Alti of the 14 realms. Sighing, I remembered when there were but 11 realms in the habitable lands of Sparrow, but as we discovered more lands and peoples, and they voted to petition to become realms of the kingdom, I've seen just in the past 3 years that number grew by 3. Not to mention the Protectorate of Avalon. Protectorate. A polite way of saying occupied territory since they fell to the Knights of Sparrow after they waged a war upon us in an attempt to steal our resources and enslave our people with the technology of the great wizards of the before that they possessed. We had fought for and won the freedom of the people of the 3 Outlands which Avalon had conquered and enslaved. A tragedy that, since most of the Avalonian people were not even aware of the disposition of the Outlands, as they were told by their government that the barbaric Outlands were working with Avalon, exchanging resources, material, and labor for education and the protection of Avalon. When in truth, the Avalonian military had conquered those lands, enslaved the peoples, and systematically stripped the lands of any resources needed to keep Avalon from falling to the ravages of time. I almost jumped when Rain said from beside me in the tongue of the people, "Ah, you've heard it, I see. Your smile betrays you. I heard the Lightbringer's voice calling your name in the whispers, playful and loving in the days before our first meeting. The future speaking to me of your coming." I gasped out, realizing my hand was already halfway to the small dagger in my boot, an unfortunate side effect of my many years of training as a knight and Kanzet form Femea de Sabie training. "Don't sneak up on a woman like that. You almost gave me a heart attack." I felt her overwhelming magic tugging at me and realized she was tucking all of me into the now, into the present we were currently experiencing. The other future versions of myself, or were they past versions, she pulled into one present. She grinned, Better. It is disconcerting when you are flitting around, blurring in and out of time like that. I felt the burn of a blush on my cheeks. I hadn't even realized I had pushed the ghosts of myself a few seconds forward as I relaxed and let the voices of Father Stone inside me. It is almost my natural state now, and has saved me on numerous occasions in battle, and even from two assassination attempts in the past year alone. I rasped out from my damaged vocal cords, "Sorry, I was just trying to relax. How did you ever catch your breath when you were co-ruler with King George?" She gave a humorless chuckle as she balanced the point of a dagger on her fingertip. "Ah, that is your folly, believing I ever had the chance to catch my breath. Being a ruler is a state of being, not a job like chicken herding in your case, or a minstrel in mine. It is all-consuming for the sake of all those who look up to you for guidance, for strength and assurance, to feel safe." I grumped. Sounds like lip service. The tall, dangerous mountain gypsy tilted her head back, her dark locks pooling on her shoulders, and gave one of the heartfelt laughs that she couldn't help but smile at. It was so good to hear her laugh again. She had lost her humor, her light, when the man she loved and my friend, Sir Bowen, had died in my stead when he took a shot meant for me in the Battle of Aretrea in Newholm. But her new wife, my sister, Sylvia, had reignited that fire inside her, showing her she could love again. She placed a hand on my arm and her smile went wistful and showed me she knew what I was thinking while she stared off into the garden valley that was hidden by magic from the world outside of it. "I sometimes think I can hear him on the wind. It isn't uncommon for those who are not touched, but spent much of their lives around those who are, to be heard in the whispers." I sighed for her broken heart, but was also happy that she and Syl had found their own happiness. Then I asked plainly, "Not that I don't enjoy your company, but why are you here, Rain? It can't be to just catch up with a friend."
"Friend? Lainey, dear, we are family."
"You know what I mean, Smarty Pants." She laughed again, getting me grinning, even though dread was building in me. She was going to take me away from the only moment of peace I've had in months, wasn't she?
"Where is your lovely bride and my delightful grandchildren?"
Yep, it was like that. I sighed again, overdramatically for her benefit, and pointed lazily into the valley. "They're fishing down by the lake." She nodded almost sadly and said,
"We should collect them. You are needed."
Of course. I stood and stretched and looked around the gardens. The secluded little valley had high peaks all around it, with no other way to reach it besides a tunnel, which was hidden by magic so ancient and powerful that I couldn't comprehend their casting. The gardens had a glowing beauty beyond compare, with trees, plants, and flowers rolling off into the distance, mists coming from the waterfalls that fell from the peaks into various lakes that seemed to ring the entire valley, giving the place an almost ethereal look. Odd large butterflies and smaller colorful ones flitted around to gather the nectar from the strange flowers. Tall and majestic deer with long, straight horns foraged the sweet-smelling grasses near the ancient, well-preserved gypsy wagon, not 25 yards from the tunnel. The deer, like the other animals in the garden, were protected from man here, so were not afraid of us, as they hadn't been hunted by bow or by spear in centuries, cut off from the outside world. The Garden of the Great Mother preserves all the dying and threatened species of plants and animals in Sparrow, giving them a chance to thrive again, until such time as the Great Mother deems it time for them to be reintroduced back into the world. I would not be that Great Mother, as long as I hold the title. They would be held safe in the gardens, and in my heart. I had to smile. My eldest daughter, Misty, who is the most powerful nature elemental Sparrow has seen in ages, has taken it upon herself to search out other threatened species to give them a new home and new hope here in the valley. Rain flipped the knife on the tip of her finger, cocked her hip, and the dagger landed neatly in its sheath. I shoved her shoulder as I stood. Flamboyant show-off. I looked around as I dusted some yellow pollen off my boots. Where's Syl? She grinned and indicated the wagon, where I saw smoke drifting out of the stovepipe on the roof. I blinked. Just how out of it was I that I hadn't heard them come in or apparently set camp? Rain seemed to know what I was thinking yet again as she assured me,
"You needed to commune with the world, and we didn't wish to disturb you, so we were extra sneaky."
Smiling, I bantered. How extra sneaky you right upside the head, woman. She snorted. Well, I didn't blame her. I posed less than zero physical threat to her. There were few knights that would be her equal with a blade, my wife being one of them. Rain was among the most dangerous women in all of Sparrow, and undoubtedly held the most magic inside her than any other woman, though she insists that my Misty may eclipse her by the time my daughter hits her age of consent. I inhaled to sigh again, but her cocked eyebrow showed me she was wise to my theatrics. She bowed slightly, though she was among the very few people in the realms who didn't need to. Being a retired great mother put her outside of the rule of man, just as the Templars of Sparrow were. With a flourish of her hand and a teasing, "After you, great mother," she ushered me forward. And before I could start walking down the hill toward the first of the lakes below, she stepped off on her own with a jaunty gait. I chased after her at a jog to keep up with my much shorter stride, calling out in English, "Hey, wait up, wench. You just now said after me like 3 seconds ago."
"How does George put it? You snooze, you lose, great mother."
"I hate you."
"No, you don't."
"Fine, I love you, but you aren't as funny as you think you are."
"Yes, I am."
Fine, whatever. She was as funny as she thought she was. I giggled and took the lead since the silly gypsy didn't know which lake my family was currently at. As we walk, I asked, "When did you arrive?" She shrugged.
"About an hour ago. Sale threatened me with great bodily harm if I disturbed your communion with Father Stone, that you needed to relax, but I'm impatient."
Her unrepentant grin told me she wasn't sorry one bit.
"You are so bad." "I'm just oddly relieved that all the pressure is finally off my own shoulders. But I know that you can take the burden, Lainey, else it wouldn't be quite as humorous. Mind you that it would still be humorous, just not as much so if you were ill-equipped to take the responsibility."
I rolled my eyes. She was incorrigible. I smirked when she stumbled a little when two misty versions of me returned to merge with me after I sent them ahead to shove her shoulder. Rennell just chuckled and told me,
"You are getting better with your control over your magics. I didn't even see when you pushed yourself forward that time."
I smirked. "When you looked back at the wagon while you spoke of Syl."
"Ah, used my weakness against me."
"I'll let Sylvia know you view her as a weakness." She chuckled.
"You're a horrible, horrible woman. I don't even know why I chose you and your wife as my mostenitors."
She furrowed her brow as she took a bite of an apple from the blade in her hand. Where had those come from?
"I didn't know that Celeste fished. She doesn't strike me as the patient type."
It was my turn to chuckle at her. Oh, she fishes with no bait or hooks on her line. She just uses the time to relax and find serenity within herself to prepare for our next trial in life. The serious but mischievous look on her face told me that the next trial would be sooner than any of us would like. Mother Luna. Couldn't we get just a day of peace before being thrust into the machinations of the realms again? It seemed that someone somewhere was always in need of us. Oh well, there was nothing for it then. I glanced from the path in front of back the way we came and asked with a smirk, Oh yes,
Inger is here.
She placed the back of her head on her forehead and overdramatically acted out, in a good approximation of Inger's voice,
"It's been forever since I've seen Misty."
Then she rolled her eyes.
"They were together just before your trip to Avalon last week. I swear, all teens have to be so dramatic all the time."
Nodding, I affirmed, "Misty is the exact same." I affected Misty's tone.
"But Mom, why couldn't Inger come with us? Or why can't it just stay with Auntie Syl?"
My daughter knew exactly why. First, Sylvia and Rain hadn't seen their daughter in a month, which is why I suspected they had come to Carnival at Wexbury a few weeks earlier than anticipated. And President Cutter? Esme hadn't seen Misty in a few months, her duties as president of Avalon demanding all her attention. I understood the feeling. Esmeralda was the logical choice for Sparrow to install as leader pro tempore of the occupied territory. Imagine her dismay and my delight when it was made official by a vote from their people. Though it was a close thing.
The anti-Sparrow sentiment is thick in Avalon, as most of the people had been kept in the dark and fed propaganda about the savage horde of Sparrow who was waging unprovoked war against their people. So imagine their response when our forces were delivered upon their doorstep in the final battle of the years-long war, which defeated President Kensington and the military forces loyal to him. The Purist Party, a faction that sanctioned violence against Sparrow, had taken 40% of the vote. I still didn't fully understand how their democracy worked. It seemed so alien to me, as Sparrow was a feudal monarchy system with a king who ruled over all. And even that has changed, as the Alti and the people have formed one people now, with dual rulers that represent the two peoples. Every 10 years, the primary leadership is passed from one to the other. It is a merging of cultures. Though I could see the allure of the democratic way of governance, where every person had a vote, every person had a voice. But we saw firsthand how that system could be manipulated so that one group of people could stay in power, rendering it basically the same as a monarchy, but by duplicity. I don't envy Esme at all, as the atrocities her people had perpetrated upon the Outlands for so many years have been laid bare to the population, showing them that all they were told about the lands beyond the glass was a lie. As much as she protested, Misty had a great time in Avalon, visiting her honorary aunt and the zoological domes in the frozen land that housed so many animals and plants thought to be extinct after the Great Impact. To my embarrassment and chagrin, Misty has a certain affinity for the platypus pool since it is on our family crest. And with our visit, we brought dozens of more chickens to bolster their rapidly growing population of the meat and laying birds. Theirs had been wiped out long ago by an aggressive avian sickness, and they believed them extinct until we reintroduced them. Esme herself was gifted the first flock by me, as well as strawberry seeds to start new crops of the lost berries in Avalon. I've learned that she is doing quite financially well because of both now. Rain couldn't contain her smile of joy when we came out of a heavily forested path to a hill above the bank of a river flowing into the small lake or oversized pond that my family favored. There, sitting on the ground with her back to a tree holding a fishing pole, was my wife, Celeste, looking relaxed and peaceful, her fiery mane of red hair hanging over her face as if she slept, a state I have rarely seen her in even before I was thrust into my current position, and it warmed my heart to see. And just a few yards away, standing knee-deep in the water, were our daughters, Misty and Shanicia. Misty, who has grown like a weed the past 3 years and is now taller than me, was patting the water with her palm, and fish were drawn to her as her magic she could barely contain flowed almost freely from her, calling out to those fish. It was like this wherever she went. Animals just flocked to her. I had to cover my mouth with my white silk glove that covered my scars and my missing finger to stop from snorting when I saw Bitsy, Misty's little rock hopper, standing on its long hind legs, grasping her chestnut brown locks as the cute little rodent chittered a reprimand at the girls, my hand leaving wispy afterimages from the magics of the people that leaked from me at all times. Rennell's grin turned mischievous again, and she silently slipped her dagger out and flipped it so the blade wouldn't strike first, and flicked it toward my wife. The three girls exploded into swift, graceful motion as my red-headed warrior caught the blade without looking as she rolled to her feet, her sword drawn toward the enemy just as my girls spun toward us in the water, Misty's blade, Anadelea, a mirror of my Anadele, drawn. I had to blink at Shan, who had what appeared to be Celeste's short parrying blade, looking almost like a longsword in her small hands, as she plucked Bitsy off of Misty's shoulder to pocket her and give her older sister room to fight. Celeste looked up toward us, and then rolled her eyes when she saw us above them on the hill and lowered her blade. She flung the dagger back, and Rennell deftly caught it as the girls excitedly sheathed their blades. My wife chastising, "Shan, how did you get my blade? What did I tell you about procuring other people's belongings?" I could see the blush on her cheeks, even on her ebony skin, a contrast to her sister's pale ivory complexion.
Don't get caught?
No, the other thing.
Oh, don't do it.
Celeste touched her nose and then pointed at our daughter. I sighed. I would have to discipline her again. My wife, for being one of the most terrifying people on a field of battle, was a pushover with our daughters. I cocked my head to regard the softy as the girls squealed and ran up to us to get hugs from their mountain gypsy grandmother, who looked more like my older sister than a woman over 50. Her magic slowed her aging, as it is apt to do, the more powerful you are.
The Knight of my heart kept eye contact with me as she gathered her things, anticipating that we were needed for something since Rain was here. This woman who was so gentle with our children and loving toward me was a woman forged in battle, adept in warfare. Called the Harbinger of Wexbury by those who have shared a field of battle with her, and the Lightbringer by the gypsies who watched her magic ignite in her for the first time. I thought it amazing that she was these two diametrically opposed people in one body, and she was mine.
What is it, Lainey?
I shrugged, feeling bashful as I rasped out, Nothing. I was just thinking about how lucky I am to have you. The girls started making gagging sounds as Rain chuckled.
You two can give cavities at 50 yards. How is it you're still in your sweet honeymoon phase?
Shan said, We should go to the wagon before they start kissing again.
She mimed kissing the air. Misty looked about to join in the teasing, but then her large brown eyes widened, making her look almost innocent as she made a realization, blurting,
Is Inger hit? Yes, at the wagon.
With that, my girl was gone without a goodbye, dashing up the path, making excited sounds. Shanicia hot on her trail, but not before handing Celeste's parrying blade back to her. We turned to Rennell, who was looking at the girls wistfully.
They grow up too fast. Shani has to have grown 4 hands since you first fostered her. And Misty, I think she'll wind up almost as tall as you, Celeste. She's already taller than our great mother Lainey here.
My wife, tongue-in-cheek, perpetuated the running joke about my diminutive height. Just a little. Then, before I could kick her butt with a cross-kick behind my back, she asked point-blank,
What fresh hell do you bring on your heels for us this time, woman?
With that, Rain tilted her head back again for another hearty laugh. Celeste winced.
That bad, huh? Come up to the wagon. We must talk.
Mother Luna. I was screwed, wasn't I? Chapter 1. Templar Hall. The news that the former Great Mother brought us was, to our surprise, not doom and gloom as we had expected. Rather, it was quite exciting instead. That's how we ended up in Templar Hall 3 days later. I refuse to call it Templarville. We could have traveled the distance in just a couple hours in the Outrider, but when I go to Father Stone, I insist on traveling on horseback. So I always decline when Sir Bexington offers to fly us in his airship, the fastest and most agile courier dirigible in the Sparrow fleet. The transformation of the area since the excavation of the city from the before times never ceases to amaze me. Back when I was scavenging metals and technology from the before to pay for Mother's medicines, I had discovered this buried settlement originally thought to be a village called Gus Davis Ford. It was discovered later that it was called Cedar Ridge and was a sprawling metropolis the size of Highland or Solomon Keeps or bigger. What had started as a small excavation in what the people of Wexbury Keep had nicknamed the Dig was now over a square mile of pre-impact structures and technology unearthed and a constantly growing huge village expanding from Templar Hall, one of my family's main residences. Since I was tricked into becoming the Great Mother of Sparrow, I'm expected to have a residence in Highland, being half Altee, and as the other half of my heritage was Mountain Gypsy, and I represented that half of the new blending of cultures, I also traveled the Whispering Walls in my wagon. So we had 3 residences. Well, 4, if you count the fortress guarding the gateway at the Ribbon of Life in the Westlands, where the rim of the impact crater that circles the habitable lands there had collapsed in ancient times, giving access to the paradise inside. One of the many titles I hold now is the Duchess of Newholme there. How had my life become so complex? I find myself longing for the simplicity of my life before all of the titles and responsibilities associated. Where I had but 1 home, in cheap quarter, tending our chickens. I had been at peace then, knowing my place, and not worrying that any decisions I made would affect anyone but me, Mother, and my brother Jace. Then again, I looked over at the woman who held my heart as she rode on her new paint mare, Spirit. I would never have known joy or love, or met or married Celeste, or fostered 2 beautiful daughters. If my new positions were payment for the wonder of my family and the joys they bring me, then so be it. I would pay it 1,000 times. I patted Goliath's neck as we hit the outskirts of the swelling village at Templar Hall, where yet another ring of defensive walls was going up to contain the village as it grew. My Percheron stallion, black as midnight with a blaze of white on his muzzle, was showing no signs of aging like Celeste's old stallion, Cantor. I have thought of that often, just as I have pondered the fact that Misty's little rockhopper, Bitsy, has lived multiple times the average 18 months to 2 years of the species she had discovered in the uninhabitable lands. Researching in the Cedar Ridge Library, I refuse to call it the Penny Library, and discussing it with scholars such as Celeste's father, Prime Techromancer Donovan, we think we know what is going on. Animals who are exposed to nature elementals like my mother and Misty tend to be healthier, lay bigger eggs, have sweeter milk, and gardens bloom bigger. The animals seem to live much longer lives. I always assumed our chickens outlived the others because of the breed, which lay blue eggs. But now I know they lived 2 or 3 times longer than the other chickens in Wexbury because my mother lived in our little stone cottage. Misty, being orders of magnitude more powerful than Mom, likely is responsible for the longevity of the little rodent. But Goliath? He seems just as powerful and sure-footed as the day I won him as spoils of battle. He is still the swiftest horse in all the realms. Rennell has a theory on that, and that theory is me. After I was scarred for life in the Battle of the Monolith, where I had to use myself as a conduit to channel so much magic and electricity, there are cracks in me. I spill magic from those cracks, my scars, at all times, and even with great effort, I can't completely stem the white wispy magic that falls from me. Rain believes that Goliath and those around me are constantly bathed in the mists of magic that pour out of me, and she thinks it is somehow soaking into my big, beautiful boy and affecting him much the same as Misty's magic is affecting Bitsy. Whatever the reason, I thank whatever powers that be, because I saw the pain in Celeste's eyes a couple of months back when she had to put her old mount to pasture as a reward for a long life serving as her mount in battle. I don't know if I could bear to part with Goliath that way. Celeste caught the melancholy look on me, and she looked about to ask what I was thinking of, when a short and long blast from the war horns in Templar Keep sounded, announcing my arrival in the area. I spat out in a hiss, "Mother Luna." I hated this part. I looked back at our little group. Shan and Misty's Mustangs were tethered to the beautiful pentagonal gypsy wagon that Rain and Sylvia called home. The girls were inside, but Eli wasn't with them, as he was a lookout for our band of the Lupe family now on the cusp of manhood like Jace. Rain and Syl rode in the driver's seat of the wagon. Then there were the 6 guards I could see. How I hated the lack of privacy in our lives now. 2 were from the Great Mother's Own to guard me, and 2 more who were assigned to Rain. As a former Great Mother, she would always have the protection of the guard. We all thought that ludicrous, as she was easily the most powerful magic user in all the habitable lands and infinitely deadly with both her magic and blade. I even saw her take out 3 men who tried to ambush her during the war against Avalon with her bare hands in the blink of an eye. She had snapped 1 man's neck, crushed another's trachea, and the last one, I still don't know what she did, but she struck him 3 times in different parts of his body with her fingers, and he just fell over. Dead. Then there were the 2 royal guards, accomplished knights who protected the 2 royal families. It was as if I couldn't go anywhere without an entourage, except into the garden of the Great Mother, where nobody but a Great Mother and her family could tread. I don't know how the magic worked at the cave entrance, but it somehow knew who was family and who was not. I first thought the guards were simply giving us privacy by waiting outside the cave, but I found it was simply that they could not pass. The illusion of solid rock was, in truth, solid to them. Glancing around the gathering crowds of people, I knew that another 8 or 10 guards hid or blended in out there somewhere. It was the same whenever King George and Queen Everly traveled. I caught sight of the last person of our group for an instant in my peripheral vision, and was proud I had actually glimpsed her as she sailed from rooftop to rooftop in the village, keeping the wagon in sight. My pseudo-sister Seraphine was assigned as guarda personala to my daughters. Sighing heavily, I resigned myself to it as it started while we moved toward the hall. People bowing or taking a knee as we passed, calling out Highness or Great Mother. Others who looked to be outsiders or even marauders looked around at the others, then followed suit. I no longer saw that as odd, since Cedar Ridge is one of only 3 neutral territories in all of Sparrow. Anyone is free to seek knowledge in the public library of Cedar Ridge. Marauders were arrested on sight, except if they are on a pilgrimage to Cedar Ridge or were within the borders of the lands set aside for it. I believe that those who seek knowledge would hopefully spread that knowledge and eventually seek another way of life instead of pillaging plunder.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?